Dean, my friend. It was an embarrassing moment, especially as the Dean was accompanied by another person, but entirely her fault. It was fortunate that I'd kept my clothes on. Don, she said, if you can leave off repairing that skeleton for a moment, I'd like you to meet Dr. Peter Endicott from the Medical Research Council. I mentioned your work in cirrhosis, and he was keen to meet you, to consider a funding package. She emphasized the last two words as though I was so unconnected with university politics that I might forget that funding was the center of her world. She was right to do so. I recognized Peter instantly. He was the former father candidate who worked at Deakin University and who had prompted the cup-stealing incident. He also recognized me. Don and I have met, he said. His partner is considering applying for the MD program, and we met recently at a social occasion. He winked at me. I don't think you're paying your academic staff enough. We had an excellent discussion about my work with alcoholic mice. Peter seemed highly interested, and I had to reassure him repeatedly that I had designed the research so there was no need for external grants. The dean was making hand signals and contorting her face, and I guessed that she wanted me to misrepresent my study as requiring funding so that she could divert the money to some project that would not be funded on its merits. I chose to feign a lack of comprehension, but this had the effect of increasing the intensity of the dean's signalling. It was only afterwards that I realized that I should not have left the sexual positions book open on the floor. I decided that 10 positions would be sufficient initially. More could be learned if the initial encounter was successful. It did not take long, less time than learning the cha-cha. In terms of reward for effort, it seemed strongly preferable to dancing, and I was greatly looking forward to it. I went to visit Rosie in her workplace. The PhD students' area was a windowless space with desks along the wall. I counted 8 students, including Rosie and Stefan, whose desk was beside Rosie's. Stefan gave me an odd smile. I was still suspicious of him. You're all over Facebook, Don. He turned to Rosie. You'll have to update your relationship status. On his screen was a spectacular photo of Rosie and me dancing, similar to the one that the photographer had given me and which now sat by my computer at home. I was spinning Rosie and her facial expression indicated extreme happiness. I had not technically been tagged as I was not registered on Facebook, social networking not being an interest of mine. But our names had been added to the photo. A. Prof. Don Tillman of Genetics and Rosie Jarman, PhD candidate, Psychology. Don't talk to me about it, said Rosie. You don't like the photo. This seemed a bad sign. It's Phil. I don't want him seeing this. Stefan said, You think your father spends his life looking at Facebook? Wait till he calls, said Rosie. How much does he earn? Are you screwing him? What can he bench press? Hardly unusual questions for a father to ask about a man who's dating his daughter, said Stefan. I'm not dating Don. We shared a taxi. That's all. Right, Don? Correct. Rosie turned back to Stefan, so you can stick your little theory where it fits, permanently. I need to talk to you in private, I said to Rosie. She looked at me very directly. I don't think there's anything we need to say in private. This seemed odd, but presumably she and Stefan shared information in the same way that Jean and I did. He had accompanied her to the ball. I was reconsidering your offer of sex, I said. Stefan put his hand over his mouth. There was quite a long silence. I would estimate 6 seconds. Then Rosie said, Don, it was a joke, a joke. I could make no sense of this. I could understand that she might have changed her mind. Perhaps the problem around the sexual objectification response had been fatal. But a joke? Surely I could not be so insensitive to social cues to have missed the fact that she was joking. Yes, I could be. I had failed to detect jokes in the past, frequently. A joke. I had been obsessing about a joke. Oh, when should we meet about the other project? Rosie looked down at her desk. There is no other project. Chapter 19. For a week, I did my best to return to my regular schedule, using the time freed up by Eva's cleaning and the cancellation of the father project to catch up on the karate and aikido training that I'd been missing. Sensei, Fifth Dan, a man who says very little, especially to the black belts, pulled me aside as I was working the punching bag in the dojo. "Something hath made you very angry," he said. That was all. He knew me well enough to know that once an emotion was identified, I would not let it defeat me. But he was right to speak to me because I'd not realized that I was angry. I was briefly angry with Rosie because she unexpectedly refused me something I wanted. But then I became angry with myself over the social incompetence that had doubtless caused Rosie embarrassment. I made several attempts to contact Rosie and got her answering service. Finally, I left a message. "What if you get leukemia and don't know where to source a bone marrow transplant? Your biological father would be an excellent candidate with a strong motivation to assist. Failure to complete the project could result in death. There are only 11 candidates remaining." She did not return my call. "These things happen," said Claudia over the third coffee meeting in 4 weeks. "You get involved with a woman, it doesn't work out." So that was it. I had, in my own way, become involved with Rosie. What should I do? "It's not easy," said Claudia. "But anyone will give you the same advice. Move on. Something else will turn up." Claudia's logic, built on sound theoretical foundations and drawing on substantial professional experience, was obviously superior to my own irrational feelings. But as I reflected on it, I realized that her advice, and indeed the discipline of psychology itself, embodied the results of research on normal humans. I'm well aware that I have some unusual characteristics. Was it possible that Claudia's advice was not appropriate for me? I decided on a compromise course of action. I would continue the wife project. If, and only if, there was further time available, I would use it for the father project, proceeding alone. If I could present Rosie with a solution, perhaps we could become friends again. Based on the Bianca disaster, I revised the questionnaire, adding more stringent criteria. I included questions on dancing, racket sports, and bridge to eliminate candidates who would require me to gain competence in useless activities and increase the difficulty of the mathematics, physics, and genetics problems. Option C, moderately, would be the only acceptable answer to the alcohol question. I organized for the responses to go directly to Jean, who was obviously engaging in the well-established research practice of making secondary use of the data. He could advise me if anyone met my criteria, exactly. In the absence of wife project candidates, I thought hard about the best way to get DNA samples for the father project. The answer came to me as I was boning a quail. The candidates were doctors who would presumably be willing to contribute to genetics research. I just needed a plausible excuse to ask for their DNA. Thanks to the preparation I'd done for the Asperger's lecture, I had one. I pulled out my list of 11 names. 2 were confirmed dead, leaving 9, 7 of whom were living overseas, which explained their absence at the reunion. But 2 had local phone numbers. 1 was the head of the Medical Research Institute at my own university. I rang it first.
"Professor Lefevre's office," said a woman's voice.
"It's Professor Tillman from the Department of Genetics. I'd like to invite Professor Lefevre to participate in a research project."
"Professor Lefevre is on sabbatical in the US. He'll be back in 2 weeks."
"Excellent. The project is presence of genetic markers for autism in high-achieving individuals. I require him to complete a questionnaire and provide a DNA sample." 2 days later, I had succeeded in locating all 9 living candidates and posted them questionnaires, created from the Asperger's research papers and cheek scrapers. The questionnaires were irrelevant, but were needed to make the research appear legitimate. My covering letter made clear my credentials as a professor of genetics at a prestigious university. In the meantime, I needed to find relatives of the 2 dead doctors. I found an obituary for Dr. Gerhard von Dein, a victim of a heart attack, on the internet. It mentioned his daughter, a medical student at the time of his death. I had no trouble tracking down Dr. Brigitte von Dein, and she was happy to participate in the survey. Simple. Jeffrey Case was a much more difficult challenge. He had died a year after graduating. I had long ago noted his basic details from the reunion website. He had not married, and he had no known children. Meanwhile, the DNA samples trickled back. Two doctors, both in New York, declined to participate. Why would medical practitioners not participate in an important study? Did they have something to hide, such as an illegitimate daughter in the same city that the request came from? It occurred to me that if they suspected my motives, they could send a friend's DNA. At least refusal was better than cheating. Seven candidates, including Dr. von Dein Jr., returned samples. None of them was Rosie's father or half-sister. Professor Simon Lefever returned from his sabbatical and wanted to meet me in person. "I'm here to collect a package from Professor Lefever," I said to the receptionist at the city hospital where he was based, hoping to avoid an actual meeting and interrogation. I was unsuccessful. She buzzed the phone, announced my name, and Professor Lefever appeared. He was, I assumed, approximately 54 years old. I had met many 54-year-olds in the past 13 weeks. He was carrying a large envelope, presumably containing the questionnaire, which was destined for the recycling bin, and his DNA. As he reached me, I tried to take the envelope, but he extended his other hand to shake mine. It was awkward, but the net result was that we shook hands and he retained the envelope. "Simon Lefever," he said. "So, what are you really after?" This was totally unexpected. Why should he question my motives? "Your DNA," I said, "and the questionnaire for a major research study. Critical." I was feeling stressed, and my voice doubtless reflected it. "I'm sure it is," Simon laughed. "And you randomly select the head of medical research as a subject. We were looking for high achievers. What's Charlie after this time?" "Charlie? I didn't know anyone called Charlie." "All right," he said. "Dumb question. How much do you want me to put in?" "No putting in is required. There is no Charlie involved. I just require the DNA and the questionnaire." Simon laughed again. "You've got my attention. You can tell Charlie that. Shoot me through the project description and the ethics approval, the whole catastrophe. Then I can have my sample," I said. "A high response rate is critical for the statistical analysis. Just send me the paperwork." Simon Lefevre's request was entirely reasonable. Unfortunately, I did not have the required paperwork because the project was fictitious. To develop a plausible project proposal would potentially require hundreds of hours of work. I attempted an estimate of the probability that Simon Lefever was Rosie's father. There were now four untested candidates. Lefever, Jeffrey Case, dead, and the two New Yorkers, Isaac Esler and Solomon Freiberg. On the basis of Rosie's information, any one of them had a 25% probability of being her father. But having proceeded so far without a positive result, I had to consider other possibilities. Two of our results relied on relatives rather than direct testing. It was possible that one or both of these daughters were, like Rosie, the result of extra-relationship sex, which, as Jean points out, is a more common phenomenon than popularly believed. And there was the possibility that one or more of my respondents to the fictitious research project might have deliberately sent a false sample. I also had to consider that Rosie's mother might not have told the truth. It took me a long time to think of this, as my default assumption is that people will be honest. But perhaps Rosie's mother wanted Rosie to believe that her father was a doctor, as she was, rather than a less prestigious person. On balance, I estimated the chance that Simon Lefever was Rosie's father was 16%. In developing documentation for the Asperger's research project, I would be doing an enormous amount of work with a low probability that it would provide the answer. I chose to proceed. The decision was barely rational. In the midst of this work, I received a phone call from a solicitor to advise me that Daphne had died. Despite the fact that she had been effectively dead for some time, I detected in myself an unexpected feeling of loneliness. Our friendship had been simple. Everything was so much more complicated now. The reason for the call was that Daphne had left me what the solicitor referred to as a small sum in her will, $10,000. And she had also left a letter written before she'd gone to live in the nursing home. It was handwritten on decorative paper. "Dear Don, thank you for making the final years of my life
so stimulating. After Edward was admitted to the nursing home, I did not believe that there was much left for me. I'm sure you know how much you have taught me and how interesting our conversations have been. But you may not realize what a wonderful companion and support you have been to me. I once told you that you would make someone a wonderful husband, and, in case you have forgotten, I'm telling you again. I'm sure if you look hard enough, you will find the right person. Do not give up, Don. I know you don't need my money, and my children do, but I've left you a small sum. I would be pleased if you would use it for something irrational. Much love. Your friend, Daphne Speldewind. It took me less than 10 seconds to think of an irrational purchase. In fact, I allowed myself only that amount of time to ensure that the decision was not affected by any logical thought process. The Asperger's research project was fascinating but very time-consuming. The final proposal was impressive, and I was confident it would have passed the peer review process if it had been submitted to a funding organisation. I was implying it had been, though I'd stopped short of forging an approval letter. I called Lefevre's personal assistant and explained that I had forgotten to send him the documents, but would now bring them personally. I was becoming more competent at deception. I arrived at reception, and the process of summoning Lefevre was repeated. This time he was not holding an envelope. I tried to give him the documents, and he tried to shake my hand, and we had a repeat of the confusion that had occurred the previous time. Lefevre seemed to find this funny. I was conscious of being tense. After all this work, I wanted the DNA. "Greetings," I said. "Documentation as requested. All requirements have been fulfilled. I now need the DNA sample and questionnaire." Lefevre laughed again and looked me up and down. Was there something odd about my appearance? My T-shirt was the one I wear on alternate days, featuring the periodic table, a birthday gift from the year after my graduation, and my trousers were the serviceable pair that are equally suitable for walking, lecturing, research and physical tasks, plus high-quality running shoes. The only error was that my socks, which would have been visible below my trousers, were of slightly different colours, a common error when dressing in poor light. But Simon Lefevre seemed to find everything amusing. "Beautiful," he said. Then he repeated my words in what seemed to be an attempt to imitate my intonation. "All requirements have been fulfilled." He added, in his normal voice, "Tell Charlie I promise I'll read the proposal." Charlie again. This was ridiculous. "The DNA," I said forcefully. "I need the sample." Lefevre laughed as though I'd made the biggest joke of all time. There were tears running down his face, actual tears. "You've made my day." He grabbed a tissue from a box on the reception desk, wiped his face, blew his nose, and tossed the used tissue in the bin as he left with my proposal. I walked to the bin and retrieved the tissue. Chapter 20. I sat with a newspaper in the university club reading room for the third day in succession. I wanted this to look accidental. From my position, I could observe the queue at the counter where Rosie sometimes purchased her lunch, even though she was not qualified to be a member. Jean had given me this information reluctantly. "Don, I think it's time to leave this one alone. You're going to get hurt." I disagreed. I'm very good at dealing with emotions. I was prepared for rejection. Rosie walked in and joined the queue. I got up and slipped in behind her. "Don," she said, "what a coincidence. I have news on the project." "There's no project." "I'm sorry about the last time you saw me." "Shit." "You embarrass me and I say sorry." "Apology accepted," I said. "I need you to come to New York with me."
"What?"
"No, no, Don. Absolutely not." We had reached the cash register and failed to select any food and had to return to the tail of the queue. By the time we sat down, I had explained the Asperger's research project. I had to invent an entire proposal, 371 pages, for this one professor. I'm now an expert on the savant syndrome. It was difficult to decode Rosie's reaction, but she appeared to be more amazed than impressed. "An unemployed expert if you get caught," she said. "I gather he's not my father."
"Correct."
I had been relieved when Lefevre's sample had tested negative.
even after the considerable effort that had been required to obtain it. I had already made plans, and a positive test would have disrupted them. There are now only three possibilities left. Two are in New York, and both refused to participate in the study. Hence, I have categorized them as difficult, and hence I need you to come to New York with me. New York? Don, no. No, 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 no. You're not going to New York, and neither am I. I had considered the possibility that Rosie would refuse, but Daphne's legacy had been sufficient to purchase two tickets. If necessary, I will go alone, but I'm not confident I can handle the social aspects of the collection. Rosie shook her head. This is seriously crazy. You don't want to know who they are, I said. Two of the three men may be your father. Go on. Isaac Esler, psychiatrist. I could see Rosie digging deep into her memory. Maybe, Isaac, I think so, maybe a friend of someone. Shit, so long ago. She paused, and? Solomon Freiberg, surgeon. No relation to Max Freiberg. Maxwell is his middle name. Shit. Max Freiberg. He's gone to New York now. No way. You're saying I've got one chance in three of being his daughter, and two chances in three of being Jewish. Assuming your mother told the truth, my mother wouldn't have lied. How old were you when she died? 10. I know what you're thinking, but I know I'm right. It was obviously not possible to discuss this issue rationally. I moved to her other statement. Is there a problem with being Jewish? Jewish is fine. Freiberg is not fine. But if it's Freiberg, it would explain why my mother kept mum. No pun intended. You've never heard of him? Only as a result of this project. If you followed football, you would have. He was a footballer, a club president, and well-known jerk. What about the third person? Jeffrey Case. Oh, my God. Rosie went white. He died. Correct. Mum talked about him a lot. He had an accident, or some illness, maybe cancer. Something bad, obviously. I didn't think he was in her year. It struck me now that we had been extremely careless in the way we had addressed the project, primarily because of the misunderstandings that had led to temporary abandonments followed by restarts. If we had worked through the names at the outset, such obvious possibilities would not have been overlooked. Do you know any more about him? No. Mum was really sad about what happened to him. Shit. Makes total sense, doesn't it? Why she wouldn't tell me. It made no sense to me. He was from the country, Rosie said. I think his father had a practice out in the sticks. The website had provided the information that Jeffrey Case was from Moree in northern New South Wales, but this hardly explained why Rosie's mother would have hidden his identity if he was the father. His only other distinguishing feature was that he was dead, so perhaps this was what Rosie was referring to, her mother not wanting to tell her that her father had died. But surely Phil could have been given this information to pass on when Rosie was old enough to deal with it. While we were talking, Jean entered. With Bianca. They waved to us then, went upstairs to the private dining section. Incredible.
Gross, said Rosie.
He's researching attraction to different nationalities.
Right. I just pity his wife.
I told Rosie that Jean and Claudia had an open marriage.
Lucky her, said Rosie.
Are you planning to offer the same deal to the winner of the wife project?
Of course, I said.
Of course, said Rosie. If that was what she wanted, I added, in case Rosie had misinterpreted.
You think that's likely?
If I find a partner, which seems increasingly unlikely, I wouldn't want a sexual relationship with anyone else, but I'm not good at understanding what other people want.
Tell me something I don't know, said Rosie, for no obvious reason.
I quickly searched my mind for an interesting fact.
The testicles of drone bees and wasp spiders explode during sex.
It was annoying that the first thing that occurred to me was related to sex. As a psychology graduate, Rosie may have made some sort of Freudian interpretation, but she looked at me and shook her head. Then she laughed.
I can't afford to go to New York.
But you're not safe by yourself. There was a phone number listed for an M case in Moree. The woman who answered told me that Dr. Case Sr., whose name was confusingly also Jeffrey, had passed away some years ago, and that his widow Margaret had been in the local nursing home with Alzheimer's disease for the past 2 years. This was good news. Better that the mother was alive than the father. There is seldom any doubt about the identity of the biological mother. I could have asked Rosie to come with me, but she had already agreed to the New York visit, and I did not want to create an opportunity for a social error that might jeopardize the trip. I knew from my experience with Daphne that it would be easy to collect a DNA sample from a person with Alzheimer's disease. I hired a car and packed swabs, cheek scraper, Ziploc bags and tweezers. I also took a university business card from before I was promoted to associate professor. Dr. Don Tillman receives superior service in medical facilities. Moree is 1,230 kilometres from Melbourne. I collected the hire car at 3:43 p.m. after my last lecture on the Friday. The internet route planner estimated 14 hours and 34 minutes of driving each way. When I was a university student, I had regularly driven to and from my parents' home in Shepparton and found that the long journeys had a similar effect to my market jogs. Research has shown that creativity is enhanced when performing straightforward mechanical tasks such as jogging, cooking, and driving. Unobstructed thinking time is always useful. I took the Hume Highway north and used the precise speed indication on the GPS to set the cruise control to the exact speed limit, rather than relying on the artificially inflated figure provided by the speedometer. This would save me some minutes without the risk of law breaking. Alone in the car, I had the feeling that my whole life had been transformed into an adventure, which would culminate in the trip to New York. I had decided not to play podcasts on the journey in order to reduce cognitive load and encourage my subconscious to process its recent inputs. But after 3 hours, I found myself becoming bored. I take little notice of my surroundings beyond the need to avoid accidents, and in any case, the freeway was largely devoid of interest. The radio would be as distracting as podcasts, so I decided to purchase my first CD since the Bark experiment. The service station just short of the New South Wales border had a limited selection, but I recognised a few albums from my father's collection. I settled on Jackson Browne's Running on Empty. With the repeat button on, it became the soundtrack to my driving and reflections over 3 days. Unlike many people, I'm very comfortable with repetition. It was probably fortunate that I was driving alone. With my unconscious failing to deliver anything, I attempted an objective analysis of the state of the Father Project. What did I know? 1. I had tested 41 of 44 candidates, and also several of those of incompatible ethnic appearance. None had matched. There was the possibility that one of the 7 Asperger's survey respondents who had returned samples had sent someone else's cheek scraping. I considered it unlikely. It would be easier simply not to participate as Isaac Esler and Max Freiberg had done. 2. Rosie had identified 4 candidates as being known to her mother, Eamon Hughes, Peter Endicott, Alan McPhee, and, recently, Jeffrey Case. She had considered the first 3 as high probability, and this would also apply to Jeffrey Case. He was now clearly the most likely candidate. 3. The entire project was reliant on Rosie's mother's testimony that she had performed the critical sexual act at the graduation party. It was possible that she had lied because the biological father was someone less prestigious. This would explain her failure to reveal his identity. 4. Rosie's mother had chosen to remain with Phil. This was my first new thought. It supported the idea that the biological father was less appealing or perhaps unavailable for marriage. It would be interesting to know whether Esler or Freiberg were already married or with partners at that time. 5. Jeffrey Case's death occurred within months of Rosie's birth, and presumably the realization that Phil was not the father. It might have taken some time for Rosie's mother to organize a confirmatory DNA test, by which time Jeffrey Case might have been dead and hence unavailable as an alternative partner. This was a useful exercise. The project status was clearer in my mind. I had added some minor insights, and I was certain that my journey was justified by the probability that Jeffrey Case was Rosie's father. I decided to drive until I was tired. a radical decision, as I would normally have scheduled my driving time according to published studies on fatigue and booked accommodation accordingly. But I'd been too busy to plan. Nevertheless, I stopped for rest breaks every 2 hours and found myself able to maintain concentration. At 11:43 p.m., I detected tiredness, but rather than sleep, I stopped at a service station, refueled, and ordered 4 double espressos. I opened the sunroof and turned up the CD player volume to combat fatigue. And at 7:19 a.m. on Saturday, with the caffeine still running all around my brain, Jackson Brown and I pulled into Moree. Chapter 21. I had set the GPS to take me to the nursing home where I introduced myself as a family friend.
"I'm afraid she won't know you," said the nurse.
This was the assumption I had made, although I was prepared with a plausible story if necessary. The nurse took me to a single room with its own bathroom. Mrs. Case was asleep.
"Shall I wake her?" asked the nurse.
"No, I'll just sit here."
"I'll leave you to it. Call if you need anything."
I thought it would look odd if I left too quickly, so I sat beside the bed for a while. I guessed Margaret Case was about 80, much the same age as Daphne had been when she moved to the nursing home. Given the story Rosie had told me, it was very possible that I was looking at her grandmother. As Margaret Case remained still and silent in her single bed, I thought about the father project. It was only possible because of technology. For all but the last few years of human existence, the secret would have died with Rosie's mother. I believe it is the duty of science, of humanity, to discover as much as we can. But I am a physical scientist, not a psychologist. The woman in front of me was not a 54-year-old male medical practitioner who might have run from his parental responsibilities. She was totally helpless. It would be easy to take a hair sample or to swab her toothbrush, but it felt wrong. For these reasons and for others that I did not fully grasp at the time, I decided not to collect a sample. Then Margaret Case woke up. She opened her eyes and looked directly at me.
"Geoffrey,"
she said, quietly but very clearly. Was she asking for her husband or for her long-dead son? There was a time when I would have replied without thinking, "They're dead." Not out of malice, but because I'm wired to respond to the facts before others' feelings. But something had changed in me, and I managed to suppress the statement. She must have realized that I was not the person she had hoped to see and began crying. She was not making any noise, but there were tears on her cheeks. Automatically, because I'd experienced this situation with Daphne, I pulled out my handkerchief and wiped away the tears. She closed her eyes again, but fate had delivered me my sample. I was exhausted, and by the time I walked out of the nursing home, there were tears in my own eyes from lack of sleep. It was early autumn, and this far north the day was already warm. I lay under a tree and fell asleep. I woke to see a male doctor in a white coat standing over me, and for a frightening moment I was taken back to the bad times of 20 years ago. It was only momentary. I quickly remembered where I was, and he was only checking to see that I was not ill or dead. I was not breaking any rules. It was 4 hours and 8 minutes since I'd left Margaret Case's room. The incident was a timely reminder of the dangers of fatigue, and I planned the return trip more carefully. I scheduled a 5-minute break every hour, and at 7:06 p.m., I stopped at a motel, ate an overcooked steak, and went to bed. The early night enabled a 5 a.m. start on the Sunday. The highway bypasses Shepparton, but I took the turn off and went to the city centre. I decided not to visit my parents. The extra 16 kilometres involved in driving the full distance to their house and back to the highway would add a dangerous unplanned increment to what was already a demanding journey, but I did want to see the town. I drove past Tillman Hardware. It was closed on Sunday, and my father and brother would be at home with my mother. My father was probably straightening pictures and my mother asking my brother to clear his construction project from the dining table so she could set it for Sunday dinner. I'd not been back since my sister's funeral. The service station was open and I filled the tank. A man of about 45, BMI about 30, was behind the counter. As I approached, I recognized him and revised his age to 39. He had lost hair, grown a beard and gained weight, but he was obviously Gary Parkinson, who had been at high school with me. He'd wanted to join the army and travel. He had apparently not realized this ambition. I was reminded how lucky I was to have been able to leave and reinvent my life.
"Hey, Don,"
he said, obviously also recognizing me. "Greetings, GP," he laughed. "You haven't changed." It was getting dark on Sunday evening when I arrived back in Melbourne and returned the rental car. I left the Jackson Browne CD in the player. 2,472 kilometres according to the GPS. The handkerchief was safe in a Ziploc bag, but its existence did not change my decision not to test Margaret Case. We would still have to go to New York. I met Rosie at the airport. She remained uncomfortable about me purchasing her ticket, so I told her she could pay me back by selecting some wife project applicants for me to date. "Fuck you," she said. It seemed we were friends again. I could not believe how much baggage Rosie had brought. I had told her to pack as lightly as possible, but she exceeded the 7-kilogram limit for carry-on luggage. Fortunately, I was able to transfer some of her excess equipment to my bag. I had packed my ultralight PC, toothbrush, razor, spare shirt, gym shorts, change of underwear, and, annoyingly, bulky parting gifts from Jean and Claudia. I'd only been allowed a week's leave, and even then, the dean had made it difficult. It was increasingly obvious that she was looking for a reason to get rid of me. Rosie had never been to the United States, but was familiar with international airport procedures. She was highly impressed by the special treatment that I received. We checked in at the service desk, where there was no queue, and were accompanied through security to the business class lounge, despite travelling in economy class. As we drank champagne in the lounge, I explained that I had earned special privileges by being particularly vigilant and observant of rules and procedures on previous flights, and by making a substantial number of helpful suggestions regarding check-in procedures, flight scheduling, pilot training, and ways in which security systems might be subverted. I was no longer expected to offer advice, having contributed enough for a lifetime of flying.
"Here's to being special," said Rosie.
"So, what's the plan?" Organisation is obviously critical when travelling, and I had an hour-by-hour plan, with hours subdivided as necessary, replacing my usual weekly schedule. It incorporated the appointments that Rosie had made to meet the two father candidates, Esler the psychiatrist and Freiberg the cosmetic surgeon. Amazingly, she had made no other plans beyond arriving at the airport to meet me. At least it meant that there were no incompatible schedules to reconcile. I opened the schedule on my laptop and began outlining it to Rosie. I had not even completed my list of activities for the flight when she interrupted.
"Fast forward, Don. What are we doing in New York? Between Saturday dinner at the Eslers and Freiburg on Wednesday, which is evening, right? We have 4 whole days of New York City in between.
Saturday, after dinner, walk to the Marcy Avenue subway station and take the J, M, or Z train to Delancey Street. Change to the F train.
Overview. Sunday to Wednesday. 1 sentence per day. Leave out eating, sleeping, and travel."
That made it easy. "Sunday, Museum of Natural History. Monday, Museum of Natural History. Tuesday, Museum of Natural History. Wednesday..."
"Stop, wait, don't tell me Wednesday. Keep it as a surprise."
"You'll probably guess."
"Probably," said Rosie. "How many times have you been to New York?"
"This is my 3rd.
"And I'm guessing this is not going to be your first visit to the museum."
"No."
"What did you think I was going to do while you were at the museum?"
"I hadn't considered it. I presume you've made independent plans for your time in New York."
"You presume wrong," said Rosie. "We are going to see New York. Sunday and Monday, I'm in charge. Tuesday and Wednesday, it's your turn. If you want me to spend 2 days at the museum, I'll spend 2 days at the museum with you. But Sunday and Monday, I'm the tour guide."
"But you don't know New York."
"Nor do you."
Rosie took our champagne glasses to the bar to top them up. It was only 9:42 a.m. in Melbourne, but I was already on New York time. While she was gone, I flipped open my computer again and connected to the Museum of Natural History site. I would have to replan my visits. Rosie returned and immediately invaded my personal space. She shut the lid of the computer. Incredible. If I'd done that to a student playing Angry Birds, I would have been in the dean's office the next day. In the university hierarchy, I am an associate professor and Rosie is a PhD student. I was entitled to some respect.
"Talk to me," she said. We've had no time to talk about anything except DNA. Now we've got a week, and I want to know who you are. And if you're going to be the guy who tells me who my father is, you should know who I am.
In less than 15 minutes, my entire schedule had been torn apart, shattered, rendered redundant. Rosie had taken over. An escort from the lounge took us to the plane for the 14-and-a-half-hour flight to Los Angeles. As a result of my special status, Rosie and I had 2 seats in a row of 3. I'm only placed next to other passengers when flights are full.
"Start with your childhood," said Rosie.
All it needed was for her to turn on the overhead light for the scenario of interrogation to be complete. I was a prisoner, so I negotiated and made escape plans. "We have to get some sleep. It's evening in New York."
"It's 7 o'clock. Who goes to bed at 7?
"Anyway, I won't be able to sleep. I've brought sleeping pills." Rosie was amazed that I would use sleeping pills. She thought I would have some objection to chemicals. She was right about not knowing much about me. We agreed that I would summarize my childhood experiences, which, given her background in psychology, she would doubtless consider hugely significant, eat dinner, take the sleeping pills, and sleep. On the pretext of visiting the bathroom, I asked the cabin manager to bring out dinner as quickly as possible. Chapter 22. Telling Rosie my life story was not difficult. Every psychologist and psychiatrist I have seen has asked for a summary, so I have the essential facts clear in my mind. My father owns a hardware store in a regional city. He lives there with my mother and my younger brother, who will probably take over when my father retires or dies. My older sister died at the age of 40 as a result of medical incompetence. When it happened, my mother did not get out of bed for 2 weeks, except to attend the funeral. I was very sad about my sister's death. Yes, I was angry too. My father and I have an affective but not emotional relationship. This is satisfactory to both of us. My mother is very caring, but I find her stifling. My brother does not like me. I believe this is because he saw me as a threat to his dream of inheriting the hardware store, and now does not respect my alternative choice. The hardware store may well have been a metaphor for the affection of our father. If so, my brother won, but I'm not unhappy about losing. I do not see my family very often. My mother calls me on Sundays. I had an uneventful time at school. I enjoyed the science subjects. I did not have many friends and was briefly the object of bullying. I was the top student in the school in all subjects except English, where I was the top boy. At the end of my schooling, I left home to attend university. I originally enrolled in computer science, but on my 21st birthday made a decision to change to genetics. This may have been the result of a subconscious desire to remain a student, but it was a logical choice. Genetics was a burgeoning field. There is no family history of mental illness. I turned towards Rosie and smiled. I'd already told her about my sister and the bullying. The statement about mental illness was correct, unless I included myself in the definition of family. Somewhere in a medical archive is a 20-year-old file with my name and the words depression, bipolar disorder, OCD, and schizophrenia. The question marks are important. Beyond the obvious observation that I was depressed, no definitive diagnosis was ever made, despite attempts by the psychiatric profession to fit me into a simplistic category. I now believe that virtually all my problems could be attributed to my brain being configured differently from those of the majority of humans. All the psychiatric symptoms were a result of this, not of any underlying disease. Of course I was depressed. I lacked friends, sex, and a social life, due to being incompatible with other people. My intensity and focus were misinterpreted as mania, and my concern with the organization was labeled as obsessive-compulsive disorder. Julie's Asperger's kids might well face similar problems in their lives. However, they had been labeled with an underlying syndrome, and perhaps the psychiatric profession would be intelligent enough to apply Occam's razor and see that the problems they might face would be largely due to their Asperger's brain configuration.
"What happened on your 21st birthday?" asked Rosie. Had Rosie read my thoughts?
What happened on my 21st birthday was that I had decided that I needed to take a new direction in my life, because any change was better than staying in the pit of depression. I actually visualized it as a pit. I told Rosie part of the truth. I don't generally celebrate birthdays, but my family had insisted in this case and had invited numerous friends and relatives to compensate for my own lack of friends. My uncle made a speech. I understood that it was traditional to make fun of the guest of honour, but my uncle became so encouraged by his ability to provoke laughter that he kept going, telling story after story. I was shocked to discover that he knew some extremely personal facts and realised that my mother must have shared them with him. She was pulling at his arm, trying to get him to stop, but he ignored her and did not stop until he noticed that she was crying, by which time he had completed a detailed exposition of my faults and of the embarrassment and pain that they had caused. The core of the problem, it seemed, was that I was a stereotypical computer geek. So I decided to change.
To a genetics geek, said Rosie.
That wasn't exactly my goal, but it was obviously the outcome. When I got out of the pit to work hard in a new discipline, where was dinner?
Tell me more about your father.
Why? I wasn't actually interested in why. I was doing the social equivalent of saying over to put the responsibility back on Rosie. It was a trick suggested by Claudia for dealing with difficult personal questions. I recalled her advice not to overuse it, but this was the first occasion.
I guess because I want to see if your dad is the reason you're fucked up.
I'm not fucked up.
Okay, not fucked up. Sorry, I didn't mean to be judgmental. But you're not exactly average, said Rosie, psychology PhD candidate.
Agreed. Does fucked up mean not exactly average?
Bad choice of words. Start again. I guess I'm asking because my father is the reason that I'm fucked up.
An extraordinary statement. With the exception of her careless attitude to health, Rosie had never exhibited any sign of brain malfunction. What are the symptoms of being fucked up?
I've got crap in my life that I wish I hadn't, and I'm not good at dealing with it. Am I making sense?
Of course, I said. Unwanted events occur, and you lack certain skills for minimizing the personal impact. I thought when you said fucked up that there was some problem with your personality that you wanted to rectify.
No, I'm okay with being me.
So what is the nature of the damage caused by Phil? Rosie did not have an instant reply to this critical question. Perhaps this was a symptom of being fucked up. Finally, she spoke.
Jesus, what's taking them so long with dinner?
Rosie went to the bathroom, and I took the opportunity to unwrap the presents that Jean and Claudia had given me. They had driven me to the airport, so it was impossible not to accept the packages. It was fortunate that Rosie was not watching when I opened them. Jean's present was a new book of sexual positions, and he had inscribed in it, "In case you run out of ideas." He had drawn the Jean symbol that he uses as his signature underneath. Claudia's present was not embarrassing, but was irrelevant to the trip. A pair of jeans and a shirt. Clothes are always useful, but I had already packed a spare shirt and did not see a need for additional pants in only 8 days. Jean had again misconstrued the current nature of my relationship with Rosie, but this was understandable. I could not explain the real purpose for taking Rosie to New York, and Jean had made an assumption consistent with his world view. On the way to the airport, I had asked Claudia for advice on dealing with so much time in the company of one person.
"Remember to listen," said Claudia. "If she asks you an awkward question, ask her why she's asking. Turn it back to her. If she's a psychology student, she'll love talking about herself. Take notice of your emotions as well as logic."
Emotions have their own logic. And try to go with the flow. In fact, Rosie spent most of the remainder of the flight to Los Angeles either sleeping or watching films, but confirmed twice that I'd not offended her and she just needed time out. I did not complain. Chapter 23. We survived U.S. immigration. Previous experience had taught me not to offer observations or suggestions, and I did not need to use my letter of recommendation from David Borenstein at Columbia University, characterizing me as a sane and competent person. Rosie seemed extremely nervous, even to someone who is poor at judging emotional states, and I was worried that she would cause suspicion and that we would be refused entry for no justifiable reason, as had happened to me on a previous occasion. The official asked, "What do you do?" And I said, "Genetics researcher." And he said, "Best in the world?" And I said, "Yes." We were through. Rosie almost ran towards customs and then to the exit. I was several meters behind, carrying both bags. Something was obviously wrong. I caught up to her outside the automatic doors, reaching into her handbag. "Cigarette," she said. She lit a cigarette and took a long drag. "Just don't say anything, okay? If I ever needed a reason to give up, I've got one now. 18 and a half hours, fuck." It was fortunate that Rosie had told me not to say anything. I remained silent but shocked at the impact of addiction on her life. She finished her cigarette and we headed to the bar. It was only 7:48 a.m. in Los Angeles, but we could be on Melbourne time until our arrival in New York. What was the deal about best geneticists on the planet? I explained that I had a special O-1 visa for aliens of extraordinary ability. I had needed a visa after the occasion when I was refused entry, and this was deemed the safest choice. O-1 visas were quite rare, and yes was the correct answer to any question about the extraordinariness of my abilities. Rosie found the word alien amusing. Correction, hilarious. Since we did not have bags checked, and the immigration process had proceeded smoothly, I was able to implement my best-case alternative, and we caught an earlier flight to New York. I had made plans for the time gained through this maneuver. At JFK, I steered Rosie towards the air train. We had two subway options.
"I suppose you've memorized the timetable," said Rosie. "Not worth the effort. I just know the lines and stations we need for our journeys."
I love New York. The layout is so logical, at least uptown from 14th Street. When Rosie had telephoned Isaac Esler's wife, she was very positive about some contact from Australia and news from the reunion. On the subway, Rosie said, "You'll need an alias in case Esler recognizes your name from the Asperger survey." I had already considered this. "Austin," I said, "from Austin Powers, international man of mystery." Rosie thought this was hilarious. I had made a successful, deliberate joke that was not related to exhibiting some quirk in my personality. A memorable moment.
"Profession?" she asked.
"Hardware store owner." The idea appeared in my brain spontaneously.
"Okay," said Rosie. "Right."
We took the E-train to Lexington Avenue and 53rd Street and headed uptown.
"Where's the hotel?"
Rosie asked as I steered us towards Madison Avenue. "Lower East Side. But we have to shop first."
"Fuck, Don, it's after 5:30. We're due at the Esler's at 7:30. We don't have time for shopping. I need time to change."
I looked at Rosie. She was wearing jeans and shirt, conventional attire. I could not see the problem. But we had time. I hadn't planned to go to the hotel before dinner, but since we arrived early...
"Don, I've been flying for 24 hours. We're doing nothing more with your schedule until I've checked it for craziness."
"I've scheduled 4 minutes for the transaction," I said. We were already outside the Hermes store, which my research had identified as the world's best scarf shop. I walked in and Rosie followed. The shop was empty except for us. Perfect.
"Don, you're not exactly dressed for this."
"Dressed for shopping?" I was dressed for traveling, eating, socializing, museum visiting, and shopping. Runners, cargo pants, T-shirt, and the jumper knitted by my mother. This was not Le Gavroche. It seemed highly unlikely that they would refuse to participate in a commercial exchange on the basis of my costume. I was right. Two women stood behind the counter, one, age approximately 55, BMI approximately 19, wearing rings on all 8 fingers, and the other, age approximately 20, BMI approximately 22, wearing huge purple glasses, creating the impression of a human ant. They were very formally dressed. I initiated the transaction. "I require a high-quality scarf." Ringwoman smiled.
"I can help you with that. It's for the lady?"
"No, for Claudia." I realized that this was not helpful, but was not sure how to elaborate.
"And Claudia is..."
She made circles with her hand. "What age?" 41 years, 356 days.
"Ah," said Ringwoman. "So we have a birthday coming up."
"Just Claudia. My birthday was 32 days away, so it surely did not qualify as coming up. Claudia wears scarves, even in hot weather, to cover lines on her neck, which she considers unattractive, so the scarf does not need to be functional, only decorative." Ringwoman produced a scarf. "What do you think of this?" It was remarkably light and would offer almost zero protection against wind and cold, but it was certainly decorative as specified. Excellent. How much? We were running to schedule. This one is $1,200. I opened my wallet and extracted my credit card.
Whoa, 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 said Rosie. I think we'd like to see what else you have before we rush into anything.
I turned to Rosie. Our 4 minutes is almost up. Ringwoman put three more scarves on the counter. Rosie looked at one. I copied her, looking at another. It seemed nice. They all seemed nice. I had no framework for discrimination. It continued. Ringwoman kept throwing more scarves on the counter, and Rosie and I looked at them. Antwoman came to help. I finally identified one that I could comment intelligently on. This scarf has a fault. It's not symmetrical. Symmetry is a key component of human beauty. Rosie had a brilliant response.
Maybe the scarf's lack of symmetry will highlight Claudia's symmetry.
Antwoman produced a pink scarf with fluffy bits. Even I could see that Claudia would not approve and dropped it immediately on the reject pile.
What's wrong with it? Said Rosie.
I don't know. It's unsuitable.
Come on, she said. You can do better than that. Imagine who might wear it.
Barbara Cartland, said Ringwoman. I was not familiar with this name, but the answer suddenly came to me.
The Dean, at the ball.
Rosie burst out laughing.
Correct.
She pulled another scarf from the pile. What about this one? It was virtually transparent.
Julie, I said automatically, then explained to Rosie and the two women about the Asperger's counselor and her revealing costume. Presumably she would not want a scarf to reduce its impact.
This one. It was a scarf that I had quite liked because of its bright colours, but Rosie had rejected as too loud.
Bianca.
Exactly. Rosie had not stopped laughing. You know more about clothes than you think you do. Antwoman produced a scarf covered in pictures of birds. I picked it up. The pictures were remarkably accurate. It was quite beautiful.
Birds of the world, Antwoman said.
Oh, my God, no, said Rosie. Not for Claudia.
Why not? It's extremely interesting.
Birds of the world? Think about it, Jean.
Scarves were being sourced from multiple locations, piling rapidly, being evaluated, tossed aside. It was happening so quickly that I was reminded of the great cocktail night, except that we were the customers. I wondered if the women were enjoying their work as much as I had. In the end, I left the choice to Rosie. She chose the first scarf that they had shown us. As we walked out of the store, Rosie said,
I think I just wasted an hour of your life.
No, no, the outcome was irrelevant, I said. It was so entertaining.
Well, said Rosie, any time you need entertaining, I could use a pair of Manolo Blahniks.
From the word pair, I guessed that she was referring to shoes. Do we have time? We had already used the time that Rosie had intended for the hotel visit.
I'm kidding, I'm kidding.
It was fortunate, as we had to move quickly to arrive at the Eslers on schedule. But Rosie needed to change. There was a bathroom at Union Square Station. Rosie dashed in and reappeared looking amazingly different.
That was incredible, I said. So quick.
Rosie looked at me.
You're going like that.
Her tone suggested dissatisfaction. These are my clothes, I said. I have a spare shirt.
Show it to me.
I reached into the bag to get the alternative shirt, which I doubted Rosie would prefer, and remembered Claudia's gift. I showed the shirt to Rosie. It was a gift from Claudia, I said. I've got jeans as well, if that helps.
All hail Claudia, said Rosie. She earned the scarf.
We'll be late.
Politely late is fine.
Isaac and Judy Esler had an apartment in Williamsburg. My US cell phone card was working to specification, and we were able to navigate by GPS to the location. I hoped that 46 minutes met Rosie's definition of politely late.
Austin, remember?
Said Rosie as she rang the bell. Judy answered the door. I estimated her age as 50 and her BMI as 26. She spoke with a New York accent and was concerned that we might have become lost. Her husband, Isaac, was a caricature of a psychiatrist. Mid-50s, short, receding hair, black goatee beard, BMI 19. He was not as friendly as his wife. They offered us martinis. I remembered the effect this drink had on me during the preparation for the great cocktail night and resolved that I would have no more than three. Judy had made some fish-based canapés and asked for details of our trip. She wanted to know whether we had been to New York before, what season it was in Australia, not a challenging question, and whether we plan to do any shopping and see any museums. Rosie handled all of these questions.
Isaac's off to Chicago in the morning, said Judy. Tell him what you'll be doing there.
Just a conference, said Isaac. He and I did not need to do a great deal of talking to ensure the conversation continued. He did ask me one thing before we moved to the dining room. What do you do, Austin?